Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Vow, on faculty of the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, good to see you again.
Jack, we're back again.
Yes, we are. Yes,
glad
we
Glad to
is.
See you. Yes, we bees. Good, good. How's things going for you?
Slow but sure. The summer is always like, oh, here's a chance to read all the stuff I need to read, and then like everything and its brother like comes out of the woodwork.
Oh yeah, no.
To be like, no, you have to do all this stuff. So,
I'm the same way. I have all these things I want to read and work on, and papers to give and lectures to give that I'm preparing for in the summer, and my house has animals in the attic, and my car just got sideswiped by a truck going by here, so I've got to deal with rental cars and all that mess. And it's just one thing after another that, you know, eats up half your day every day. You think, well, I didn't get anything done today.
Right. Animals in the Attic sounds like a band name. It's
like, they could sing together.
Brings a whole new meaning to your problem. Like, I have animals in the attic. It's like, oh, really?
Oh, good. I love their latest album. Album. You people don't do albums. I'm really dating myself.
They do albums.
Do they do?
They don't call them albums? Maybe like the, you know, vinyl is making comeback.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, people, it's considered hip, cool, and groovy to release, along with your digital download, a vinyl.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Wow.
If you're like really cool and indie.
And they want you to play it on old tube amplifiers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a record player.
Oh, do you really?
Got one for Christmas a couple of years ago by my wife.
All right.
And it's very wonderful. So I say this somewhat non-derisively because I actually think it's kind of cool.
Well, I do like the sound of vinyl, I guess. I'm not sure that I can always tell the difference between digital and vinyl. Not that I've spent much time trying. But to tell you the truth, I don't listen to many recordings anyway. I just pull out the scores and look at them.
Advantages of being a composer conductor, man.
That's right. I don't like to hear them necessarily, especially before I've studied them myself, so I don't get the wrong impression. But anyway, that's all. I'm just going to cut all that.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, studying things and before we get the wrong impression.
Yeah, that's right. Very good point. Nice segue. I'm really interested in an article I saw yesterday, I guess, a friend of mine sent me that I thought was interesting. There's so much in, you know, especially in Memphis, but probably in the rest of the country, about racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And in particular in Christian circles, about how we might go about reconciling races and so on. And one of the things that churches often do is a racial reconciliation service. And this article is written by a fellow called Sam Murrell of Little Rock, Arkansas.
Right.
And in it, the title of it is Why I No Longer Participate in Racial Reconciliation Services.
Right.
He's an African-American fellow.
And a pastor, I believe.
That's right. He's a pastor. And he starts giving his reasons for why it is he doesn't think that racial reconciliation services, at least the way we've been doing them, and the approach that we've taken to race reconciliation, is helpful. So, but it made me start thinking about how we categorize people and how we, how it seems like every time I turn around, we're pitting two groups of people against each other, the poor against the rich, the 99% versus the 1%, you know, the blacks and whites, or homosexuals and heterosexuals, or men and women, exactly.
The older and the younger.
It has to be a millennial age group and a Gen X
age group.
Everybody
else, like millennials versus the world, basically.
right. And we can all sort of turn to my generation, the baby boomers, and claim that they have all sorts of characteristics that are not very favorable too. So, but I'm wondering how helpful it is. Everybody needs a little bit of shorthand, right? To make their arguments, and we're all making sort of generalities when we make arguments. But when it comes to people and putting people in categories, doesn't that cause more trouble than it's worth?
Yeah, it's So it probably should be stated up front that this is not a podcast necessarily about, or this episode is not necessarily about racial reconciliation itself.
Right, right. It's a jumping off point.
Yeah, it's like, because that article led me to like some other articles I'd read that was discussing the same issue. Hmm. Particularly, like, when I read it, it reminded me there was some dust up earlier this year between, how to pronounce his name, Tabidi Anyabwele. I think is his name,
and he's
a Baptist pastor, and he's part of the Gospel Coalition, I believe, and he's famous and a good guy, as far as I can tell. But earlier this year, it is the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death, his mm-hmm. murder, mm-hmm. The hands of James Earl Ray, and Reverend Tabidi, he's also a pastor. He wrote a couple of things that raised some concerns and raised some eyebrows about, like, complicity of, like, white people in what happened.
Yeah.
Not necessarily individual white people, but, like, white people as a category. And there were pastors and other people who, like, James White, Douglas Wilson, and others who took them to task for this. And what was interesting to me, now that's a whole nother discussion. What was interesting to me is I read, like, his stuff, I read, like, one of the guy's responses to him, and then I read the response to the response.
Uh-huh.
And Reverend Tabidi's response to the response, one of his sort of complaints is that, you know, they were accusing him of doing things and reasoning in certain ways that they themselves do. Uh-huh. And one of them was uh-huh. treating people in, like, sweeping categories, you know, about all white sure. people are like this, or all evangelicals are like this, or all African Americans are like this. They do the exact same thing. So why do they get to do it and he doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
Is that whataboutism? I don't know. That's not my point. My point is that it seems like it's what made me think of it. Because he mentioned in one of the articles, there's this argument about whether we should be colorblind or race blind or gender blind or class blind or whatever. You know, not seeing people in any categories, but seeing them as individual persons. And yet we can't seem but help to treat people categorically in
right.
some way. Like we use it
right.
all the time. And that contradiction or that tension, I guess we would say, just seems to infect this discussion constantly. Recently, I was listening to Jordan Peterson as a podcast,
mm-hmm.
not because I'm a fan or not a fan, but because I feel he's interesting to listen to. And one of his podcasts was of a debate that he had where it was him and Stephen Fry on one side.
Oh.
And the two other people whose names I can't remember, but it was a woman and it was an African-American pastor.
Mm.
And they were arguing about political correctness or something like that. And I don't think it was a particularly good debate for other reasons, but I remember that the African-American pastor committed the same exact move.
Ah.
On the one hand, he said, we want everyone to be treated as individual persons. All right? That's what we want. That's what we want. And then he turned around and called Jordan Peterson an angry white man. And that's all he was. And Peterson, of course, called him out on it, but it's like
good.
The whole thing devolved from there.
Uh-huh.
But it was the
uh-huh.
same kind of thing. It's like, well, we want to be treated like individual persons. That's why we're going to tear down white patriarchy, which is like, which all white men are complicit in. And I'm
yeah.
like, what does the category white men even mean?
Right.
It seems to be a category based on, like, the shallowest of, like, criteria. You know, like, anatomy and melanin in your skin cells, and that's it. So you're going to take a whole bunch of individual people who may be in all manner of ways completely different from each other, and yet somehow lump them all together and make them complicit of one thing.
Right.
It's like, well, that doesn't seem fair.
Well, it isn't fair. And I think while I'd love to be able to say we could just look at each other individually and not make any kind of categories like that for each other. I'd love to be able to do that. And to a degree, I guess Dr. Martin Luther King's famous quote is about that, right?
Right.
That we should be judged on our character and not on our
right.
color of our skin. Well, the interesting thing about that, by the way, is that we're still judging each other. We're
right.
just judging each other on the right things.
Right, on different criteria.
Exactly, different criteria. So, but what I was thinking is you can't get around the notion that there are categories in life, and those categories are helpful when it at times. So how do we differentiate between when it's right to use categories and when it's not? Is the dividing line between things and people, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair category? Should we not categorize people but do categorize chairs and cars and things?
Ideas.
Yeah, I mean, what's the difference between a truck and a car? Well, there's a difference, right? Or even in ideas, exactly. Like you've got here's a nominalist idea and here's a realist idea, going back to medieval philosophy. But maybe it's not so applicable for people.
What I think is excruciatingly nuanced and noncommittal. So.
Well, can we get it into this podcast?
We shall try.
Squeeze it out of you.
My issue is that I see the problem of, like, on the one hand, the way we're using categories and generalizations and stuff like that seems to be completely unhelpful and ineffectual. Simply saying everything is the fault of white patriarchy is unhelpful.
Right.
Like, you might as well... I've heard people say, you might as well say it's the fault of the Priory of Zion. Like,
right.
Well, who are we supposed to
right.
deal with? But if you turn around and say, well, that means all white men, that... I remember when I took my African-American literary theory class, I almost got convinced that the category white people, you see with the quotation marks, that category is completely meaningless.
Yeah.
Because all white people are so different. And the reason I got that is because there are African-American critics who argue that the term black people was a meaningless term because
sure.
each African-American person is their own person, like
That's
who
right.
does their own thing. And so I was like, I feel like there's categories that are completely meaningless. On the other hand, they seem unavoidable because it's almost like it's a way that we think day to day. You know, we have to like categorize in all manner of ways. A friend of mine, Zachary, always says that we have model-dependent thinking.
Yeah.
Though we have a model-independent reality.
Uh-huh.
And what he means by that is that all our model, the way we think is in models, and models work in categorizations, but reality is always bigger than the model.
That's right.
In some way. That doesn't mean that the model is, like, hopelessly inaccurate, but that, I guess a way to put it is that we have to consider all the facts, but one of the facts is that all the facts don't always cover all the facts, if I could put it that way.
Or that we don't even actually see all the facts, know all the facts. We can't make too many generalizations if we only know 50% of what's going on.
Right. So when we first started this, I was thinking of Aristotle, because why wouldn't I be? Because, like, I'm putting on my pretentious hat right now. So, like, I was thinking Aristotle had a book called Categories, that defined a lot of the way he would formally define things. Like, you're talking about the form of things. And when it came to defining human beings, he always defined them as the rational animal type way. But he saw, like, things like race and gender as an accidental feature
right.
rather than an essential feature.
Right, right.
And thus to try and categorize people by, like, race or by gender might actually be an error, or at least like to like give like their general sort of definition is above that. So it's like, well, when we are trying to categorize people, what is the definition of our categories? A. B. Is our definition actually helpful, or is it so shallow or so broad that it really isn't helpful at all? And C. If it is helpful, are the people we're putting in the category actually fall within the parameters of what we're defining the category as?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a category that would be unhelpful because it's so ill and broadly defined, like when they say, like, a white male or something like that, well, it's all white males' fault or something like that, or
right.
white males
right.
as a group means nothing to me, because it seems the criteria to get in there is just to have a certain, it's extremely shallow. It's like a certain
right.
melanin count to your skin cells and a certain kind of anatomy, and suddenly you all are in lockstep together in one
right.
group. That's an incredibly shallow criteria to get in there and doesn't account for all the complexity.
And the point is, that's what people have been, since the 60s, complaining against in the reverse. That is, not all black people are the same. If you just
right.
decide black people are all X, Y, and Z, well, then you've misjudged them. You're prejudging them. In
right.
fact, that's what prejudice is supposed to be.
Well, I almost feel like the contradiction, you could start it back there, although in the 60s, whether it be on-the-street activism or in academic intellectualism, the contradiction was already there. The contradiction of stop treating people like aggregate groups.
Uh-huh.
They're all individual persons. They say, well, who are you telling to stop? Stop doing it.
Good point.
Well, it's the monolithic, patriarchal, white, heteronormative.
Exactly.
So in order to, like, argue against treating people as, like, aggregate groups or,
yeah.
like, some sort of, like, giant monolithic group, they had to posit a monolithic group as the enemy.
Right.
And it's like, and right. I'm not on the one you asked. I'm not sure if they meant to do that or if they realized that that's what they were doing.
No.
But it seems to be a fundamental, if not contradiction, then at the very least a tension in the whole discussion. The whole discussion. It's the same thing, like I said, in the Jordan Peterson debate, to say, like, we want to treat everybody as individuals, you angry white male. Which is it? Do you want to treat people as individuals or do you not? And obviously, I think, as Americans specifically and Westerners in general, which are also two categories, I think we do want to treat people as individuals. But we need categories just to think. Like, we at all, first of all. And then second of all, more specifically, it seems like in order to figure out why individuals don't get treated like individuals, we need some giant evil of some kind, some dark lord and his dark army that we can point to and say it's their fault.
That's interesting.
And yet we don't want to, like, be caught saying, well, all individuals are like, well, you know, sweeping a bunch of individuals under this term. So somehow we want to make it ethereal. I picked up, like, in my studies and stuff being in the university, that patriarchy was somehow everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's everywhere and it's influencing everything and it's just a part of who we are. But if you ask, well, where is it? They would look at you cross-eyed, like you had said something in, you know, gibberish or something like that. It's like, well, where is it? Who is it? How do we take them out and stop them? And it's like, there, it's like the Force. It was just everywhere. It's like it's, you know, it's almost, you expect like feminist Yoda to sit there and be like, it's here in me and you, the rock and the tree. You know, it's like it's everywhere and in every single thing. And it's like,
wow.
Well, how do you even fight that? But if you, it's almost like you need a monolithic evil to fight. But in order not to be caught, you know, be accused of doing this very thing you're trying to stop, you have to make it something that you can excuse people from while still accusing people from at the same time. It's a weird dance. It's like,
well, it starts to sound like the devil himself. That is, we need some sort of ethereal reality that is evil that we can all stand against and know that he is conspiring against us, right? Well, that's actually what Satan is supposed to be like, right? As I always say, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, except for the fact that I think that Satan really does exist, and he really does want to destroy everything. So in that sense, there's a conspiracy going on.
It almost sounds like a problem
we needed that guy.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, it almost sounds like a problem we mentioned before, but the other way. We've mentioned how if we don't have God as a transcendent factor, then, you know, morality becomes a power play and all that type of jazz.
Right.
But it seems like if we don't have the devil as a transcendent factor, then what does it get reduced to? Well, it gets reduced to this sort of thing, all right? It's like a feminist talking to a man and saying, well, I think men are the problem. And the guy says, but I haven't done anything. Oh, no, I'm not talking about you.
Right.
But you said men. Like, what does the term mean? Without God, all we have is our tribes.
Yeah.
And without the devil, all we have is all the other tribes. Kind of situation.
We focus on the wrong thing then, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly all these references from the scripture come to my mind. We wrestle not against flesh and blood and all of that. It's occurred to me as we were talking that maybe one of the ways to address these things is to take up a very Christian idea, that is, that the human being is worthy of love and dignity. Whereas the ideas that he holds on to maybe aren't. I remember Peter Kreft saying some time ago, the devil would have us be elitist about people and egalitarian about ideas. I thought that was pretty profound, because people say, well, you're just being elitist about this or that. And you have to differentiate between those two kinds of elitism. Actually, there's an elitism that's good, but it's an elitism about ideas. It's not an elitism about people. God would have us be elitist about ideas and egalitarian about people.
Right. You need to be pretentiously preferential for the truth.
Exactly.
Right.
And not apologize for it, even for a little bit. And yet, we want to differentiate the person who holds a position from the position that he holds. In the same way that we say, love the sinner, hate the sin, we can say, love the person, hate the idea, if you want to. And not be cruel in the way we rip ideas from people and so on, but to oppose them as ideas and not oppose the people as people.
Right. If a category is speaking specifically of like an idea, it could be more, it definitely could be more helpful.
Seems like it would differentiate better so that we're not saying, well, black people think this way or white people think this way. We could say this idea is misguided in these ways. Mm-hmm. And then let people join with that idea or resist or reject that idea based on the validity of the argument against it.
Now, where a complication or a wrinkle may come in, because we have to be thinking about these things all the time, is, so I was thinking, like, well, we could say, you know, well, it's ideas, like saying that's right or wrong, right? I can already hear my more feminist friends, whether they be extremely progressivist types or just consider themselves feminists, saying, like, I agree, patriarchy is a bad idea. Like, they would say that when I say patriarchy, I'm not talking about men. I'm talking about an attitude that men are somehow superior and that being a man means being dominant over women and stuff.
Right.
And anybody can believe that. Like, women and men can believe that.
You have male feminists.
So there are male feminists and stuff like that. So I say, well, I agree with that. And when that happens, the wrinkle I was thinking of, and I'll see if I can tie this together now, is that ideas have consequences, right? Which means ideas are attached to behaviors.
Right.
Or can be attached to behaviors. Or there's some ideas that are so hopelessly abstract that they would never get attached to ideas, to behaviors. But ideas that have real purchase or real, like, substance to them seem to influence behavior, especially.
That's right. We live our lives differently because of what we believe, what ideas we hold on to.
So the question then becomes, like, is it possible that certain ideas take hold of certain people more and thus influences the behaviors of certain people more than others?
Sure.
So, for example, I brought up the patriarchy thing because I feel like the problem is still, this is a good example of the problem.
Yeah.
Right? You can argue that patriarchy is, when you say patriarchy, you're not talking about men, you're just talking about a certain idea that is dangerous to both men and women. All right? Because it puts up a very bad, and we could even argue, unbiblical view of, like, men and also of women in society. So
sure.
You can argue that.
Okay.
Right? At some point, though, I feel some clever troll will come along and say, like, okay, well, this idea of patriarchy obviously influences behavior, right?
Okay.
Whose behavior does it influence the most, or does it influence the most, or whose influence it is the most dramatic in? Like, it can influence women, but definitely it would be, well, it influences men. Okay. Well, the two, and probably men more dramatically, because the idea is that it'll teach them to be more dominant and stuff like that. My point is that the idea still seems to work out as behavior, still seems to want to rest on a certain group of people, not just everybody.
Right.
Even if the idea can affect everybody, it seems like the behaviors associated with that idea can, you know, fall into one group of people. Now, the reason I say that is not to be like, aha, you feminist. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that, let's stick with the patriarchy thing.
Yep, good.
If patriarchy means, and we're going to assume this definition. We could take issue with the whole idea if we want to, but we'll assume this definition. If patriarchy means a certain system of ideas or a certain set of ideas that preferences men over women because it assumes men are stronger, therefore better, therefore they have a right to dominate others, including women and stuff like that. If that's there, and therefore the behaviors that are most going to be affected by it, the more active behaviors are going to be mostly male because that's where it falls.
Mm-hmm.
What's the question I'm looking for? It's like, is that a valid way of thinking? That, well, in that case, I guess when we talk about men in that context, maybe it is appropriate because men are more likely to be affected by this thing.
Right, right. But
do you see what I mean?
Sure,
it's like once we connect the idea up to behavior, that's where it comes into contact with people.
And then the shorthand becomes just to dismiss men because they are patriarchal.
Right, or that's where the danger is. Either the shorthand can be what I've called lazy shorthand, where it's just what it means to dismiss any men.
Yeah.
Or there's cases where it feels like, is the shorthand helpful?
Right.
At all? Because, like, well, if there is patriarchal behavior, active patriarchal behavior, who's more likely to show it, men or women?
Right.
By that definition, it would be men. So it's like, well, then does the shorthand actually have... Do you see what I mean? That's the problematic thing again.
Sure.
It's like, on the popular level, and I know there's probably more, like, right-leaning listeners out there who are wanting to scream at their speakers right now. They want to say, like, look, on the popular level, the way they use it is not this helpful way. But the reason I'm trying to bring this out is why these things gain purchase. I don't automatically assume they gain purchase, and I don't think you automatically assume they gain purchase because the people they gain purchase with are a bunch of degenerate cultural Marxists that want to destroy the Republic.
Right.
I think it's because there is something in them, however error-ridden or however problematic they may be, there's something in them that's actually helpful or true or something. I'm not sure what the word is, but it gets some kind of purchase and gets us right back to the same problem of the difficulties of categorization when dealing with people.
So maybe what you're saying is prejudice as a principle is a bad idea because it lumps people together unfavorably when they shouldn't be. Some shouldn't be.
But
prejudice is usually based in some kind of a truth. I'm not talking about 100% truth. I'm talking about a percentage of truth that we used to say a generalization is something that's true 51% of the time, right?
Right.
Well, in that way, there are reasons why prejudices occur. It's not just hatred for somebody. It's that I've seen it happen 51% of the time, and I'm living in a life where I can't always rethink everything on an individualistic level.
Right.
You know, when I'm making a snap decision, we do make decisions based on things like that. The question is, again, whether we are whether the assumptions we have or the definitions of the terms that we're using and the principles and ideas that we're actually talking about are in and of themselves valid.
Yeah.
The definition you just gave of patriarchy, for example, has all sorts of problems with it, right?
Sure.
I actually don't see that patriarchy is a bad word at all. I mean, my understanding is I don't think that's a bad thing in the slightest bit. But it's because people have associated patriarchy with the sort of damaging abuse that you were just describing, that they by shorthand use the word patriarchy, which just means male headship.
Like the word literally means that.
Yeah, that's what it
means.
Not
the way it typically gets used.
In the way people use it today, they are using it in a derogatory fashion because they're associating it with the abuses of male privilege or the abuses of male power, even.
Mm-hmm.
And those abuses, I think all of us are against. So, but the point is, patriarchy actually, here's the problem. We've taken a term that actually doesn't mean that, and we've applied it to something that has become the shorthand to describe this abuse. And so when someone comes along, this is about equivocation. This is the problem of equivocation when you have you have the same word, but it's used in two different ways. Somebody uses patriarchy to mean the abuse. The other person uses patriarchy to show how, in Christian terms, how leaders are supposed to sacrifice themselves for the benefit of their followers. And that's what God calls men to do, for example, for women. So a patriarchy established that way would actually be heaven.
Right.
It would be a great thing.
Sure.
But that's not the way people, I mean, obviously we're fallen and many people abuse the kind of positions that they've been given, whether they're bosses or teachers or husbands or parents.
Yeah.
Abusing their power.
Well, you mentioning the fall brings up like the other sort of elephant in the room, I suppose. Maybe that's not
that's
the right
Higgins.
Higgins. He's the constant narcoleptic elephant in the room. I said that not having God as a transcendent reality, you know, leaves us just with our tribe, and not having the devil leaves us with just all the other tribes.
Yeah.
But the other factor besides the devil is just the fallenness.
Yeah.
Like our fallenness is the other. That's the other factor. It's like when you remove all those factors, how do you explain things going wrong?
Yeah.
You know, and the reason I'm thinking that is because you mentioned the word prejudice real quickly and you defined it and moved on. But I was thinking, you know, even in their very idea of prejudice and the way we apply it, the problem is still there, the tension I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
We want to say that, well, prejudice, you know, in this negative sense, not like I'm prejudiced for this ice cream shop because 51% of the time I've been satisfied with their service over all the others, so I go there. I mean, like negative,
sure.
You know, prejudice, you know, racial stereotyping. Also.
Sure, right.
Prejudice is this kind of treating a group of people, seeing a group of people as a group and then seeing that group negatively.
Right.
Right? That's the way we see prejudice. Okay. But in our attempt to root out prejudice, we seem to notice or argue or realize, or even put it, that there are certain prejudices seem to be more common among certain groups. So did you see what I mean?
So we were establishing a new prejudice.
So we're establishing a new prejudice in the very act of trying to unroot it.
Right.
And I feel like most of the time, you know, like in conservative or right-leaning punditry, that's like a aha moment, like a gotcha moment. But I look at it and I'm like, it seems like grouping and categorizing and sins unique to groups seems unavoidable.
Right, I know what you mean.
But you can't talk rationally about it, I think. You can't really talk rationally or commonsensically or just accurately about it if you don't have the idea of the fall at the back of all things. Because if you don't have the idea of the fall, then if you notice that, okay, so there's this particular sin, let's not call it patriarchy, because I don't know what the other word is, sexism or just domination or corruption,
abuse,
whatever you want to call it. But there's this thing that is common to the group called men, and that is this sense of being dominant and abusive in its own way. Like I say, like now already you can notice the problem, right?
Right.
Not only men are dominant and abusive.
Oh, boy.
Like, you know, there's a way for women to do it, and it's not only white men. There's a way for black men to do it and for brown men to do it and for all across the color spectrum.
Turns out it's a human thing.
So it's like it's when you have the fall, there's this backdrop of, like, we're all in the same boat. And thus, even if we want to identify, like, kind of specify things, there can be such a thing as black supremacy as well as white supremacy, but that doesn't mean white supremacy wasn't a unique sin to unique individual people who all happen to kind of fit in a similar group, but they aren't really representative of the group. But they still fit into a particular group, but they aren't representative of the group. It's like that kind of... Notice how I earlier said excruciatingly nuanced and noncommittal? That's what I mean. It's like it's the complexity of the situation of there seems to be individual sins and then sins that aggregate together. And if you don't have the fall at the background of it, then you would stop at saying, well, I guess all men are bad.
Right.
Instead of saying, like, well, I guess all men are sinful, just like all women are sinful. And here's a sin that's maybe peculiar to maleness, but we can also recognize here's a sin peculiar to femaleness, and here's a sin peculiar to, you know, white people at one time, and here's a sin peculiar to black people at one time. We can do that, but we can say it's all sin and it's all part of the fall. Without that overarching backdrop, it's much easier to, like, fall into, like, just creating new categories that you can be prejudiced against.
It requires that you be a bit humble, doesn't it? Because you know you are a member of a sinful class, whether you're a member of the class that people are complaining about today or not. In my experience, this is purely from my own experience and from maybe some teaching I had when I was first a Christian, the work of the Holy Spirit in our hearts is to convict us of our sin so that we might confess it and be done with it, right? He's working that sanctification in us. And what I find is that you can discern between voices in your head. You can discern between the voice of the Holy Spirit and the voice of the devil, in that the voice of the Holy Spirit is always extremely specific, and the voice of the devil is always generically condemning.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
no, I know what you mean.
Like maybe yesterday I hear a voice that says, "You are really a dirty, rotten person."
Right.
You know, and I think, wait, what? Huh? Where'd that come from? You know, you are just, nobody likes you, and you're not a very kind person to, you're just generally slovenly, you know, or whatever. Well, you think, well, hang on a second, wait a minute. But when the whole, that's, I think, the wrong, that's the condemnation. The Holy Spirit speaks to me like this. Yesterday at 2:30 in the afternoon, you said XYZ, and that damaged somebody's, you know, opinion, or that hurt somebody's feelings, or that was a lie. Maybe that was a lie, but that was specifically wrong, and you need to do something about that.
Yeah.
You see, so I need to call that guy up and say, you know, yesterday I told you this, and it really wasn't true. I need to straighten this out with you and ask you to forgive me. See, and so it's the idea that we should look at a group of people, in a sense, indiscriminately, seems much more like the former than the latter.
Yeah.
You know? If there's a person who is actually being bigoted at a particular time and place, we should all rise up and say, that's not good. You see, that specific instance is where you went wrong in confronting with about it, right? But to say white people in general have always been evil, or men are, you know, oppressive, or women are the whatever group.
Yeah, whatever. The feminazis.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's another category.
You get this sort of generic thing, you see. And my sort of spiritual instinct is to say, just a second, I need you to be more specific than that. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's, like you said a minute ago, it's like saying the Priory of Zion is at fault. Well, what good is that? You can't do anything about that.
Right.
So maybe what we need to do is, the first thing I suggested was stop talking about people as members of a group and start talking about the ideas that they hold. The second thing is, maybe instead of talking about the guilt of a group, we should talk about the guilt of specific instances, even at the risk of allowing for a group to continue in general in its wrong direction.
Yeah.
Because it's only going to have, the change is only going to happen by bringing about individual repentance, you see, and not sort of group repentance.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. One of the things that I've argued in my own mind, and somewhat with my peers over in the university, is that it feels like what happened in the West generally, and specifically in America, is 100 or so years or whatever, there were certain groups of people who were grouped. This is the argument.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
They were grouped in such a way that was negative, and it's been happening forever. And those tools used to group them together, the terminology and the way of going about it, was super effective to, like, keeping them down.
Uh-huh.
Right? So now that they have a voice and a chance to, like, speak against it, it seemed that a swath of them, and the ones that seemed to dominate the conversation, adopted the tools of their enemy.
Amen.
They adopted the same exact tools.
Right.
Because I remember somebody posted on Facebook, like, you know, white people need to check their privilege, which are two big categorical terms. And some black guy came on and said, look, he said, where I grew up, there was a white guy who grew up with me in the same neighborhood. We were both poor. Both our dads couldn't get loans anywhere because they were poor and they looked poor. It was hard for them to get jobs. It was hard for us to get into schools. It's like, where was his privilege? Did he forget his white guy handshake? Like, what did he forget?
Right.
And the response was, I don't like hate on my feet. I'm going to block you. Or something like that. And so he got blocked, but he was like pointing out this, like, your categorization doesn't fit the actual people I know.
Yeah.
And it's like,
but blowing those categories at another person was enough to make him want to block you and say, I can't handle that.
Yeah, it was like there's a whole swath of people who use categorization to dominate other people, to keep them locked in somewhere. And now it seems like the people who suffered that or felt like they come from the lineage that suffered that want to do the exact same thing but get different results.
Right, exactly.
And I'm like, that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
There's actually a quote in this article from this fellow, this pastor, that says, the word privilege is employed by the offended group as a weapon against the other. Once someone is labeled as privileged, he is supposed to realize his rightful place in the race conversation, and that rightful place is to be silent, to be the silent observer whose liberty to speak has been revoked. Well, we could go into all the details of it, but the idea that you use this term privilege as a weapon to silence your enemies is the opposite of wisdom. It's the opposite of wisdom. If you really want to have a conversation with somebody, the first thing you got to do is be willing to let him say what he needs to say. Mm. You know. So what I hear so often is people using terms like all these that we're talking about in the way you're just describing. Mm. That it's a way for power, to control, to have dominance over another group. Mm. And why on earth would you think that? It's like Frodo in the Ring. You know, the ring can only be used to dominate. And it's the domination that's the evil about it, see? So what they need to do is, instead of saying, hey, if I used it, I would do it right.
Which is what a bunch of people in the book say.
Everybody does, right? And they sometimes, some of them lose their lives over it.
Yeah, like, there's too many Denethors out there and not enough Gandalfs.
Exactly.
There's too many Denethors like, we'll take the ring, not to use it, just to keep it safe.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know everyone else who used the ring turned into a horrible, like, you know, got murdered or got turned into a horrible tyrant or, you know, grizzled, you know, swamp monster. Yeah. But I'm going to be...
I'll do it right.
Instead of the Gandalf thing that's like, you know, listen, I would want to use the ring for good.
Yeah.
But through me, it would wield a power too terrible to imagine. Type thing.
It would twist my desires in. I don't have enough goodness in me to resist the power, and it's the use of the power that's the evil.
Right.
This is a good point to make, actually, because I think one of the things Tolkien does so well in his book is to describe good and evil in those terms. Right. He thinks that he describes good as a reluctance to manipulate anyone else in any direction. Mm-hmm. That people with their, the only way good happens is if people are free to choose their paths themselves. And on the other hand, all the evil characters in the book are to one degree or another, dominating someone else, manipulating someone. Wormtongue with his words, you know, or on the far end of the spectrum, Sauron himself, you know, putting people in chains and limiting their choices that way. I remember reading this scene where Frodo is on his way to Bree, and in the woods one night come these elves through the forest, you know, mm-hmm. and he says, "Oh, good, you're here." And they say, "Oh yeah, well, hi Frodo, we know all about your situation." "You do? Great, you can tell me what to do." And they say, "No." And I thought at the time, "What do you mean no? What kind of elves are you? You know, help the man out. He's in trouble. He's got, you know, he doesn't know what to do. What kind of elf are you?" But they were wiser than I was in my response.
A wandering adventurer asked you for help, and you say no. What kind of elf are you?
That's right. So, but the more I read in the book, the more I realized that's what Tolkien was talking about. They knew that the best, they didn't know enough to say this is the right way to go. They could give him advice, but they knew it would be unwise to do that. It would be better for him to make choices himself. My initial response was, you know a lot more than he does. But they weren't saying we don't know more than he does. They were saying we know enough to know what happens when you give advice.
Right.
You know, you don't want to do that.
Reminds me, we keep seeing from like the, you know, racist slave owners and slave arguers of the 1800s and the Jim Crow advocates of the 20th century to white neo-Nazi supremacist people today, to the radicals from the 60s and the intersectional types of the day, they're all doing the exact same thing. They're, amongst other things, they're using categorization as a means to dominate.
Right.
As a means to control. And that raises the question of, maybe one of the problems is we're not stopping to ask, what is categorization and generalization for? Like, mm-hmm. What is it actually for?
There's a good Aristotelian.
And I feel like, speaking of Aristotelian,
yeah.
I feel like categorization and generalization is meant to just be formally descriptive, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not meant to be, when I mean formal, I mean, even for Aristotle, it meant the most generic thing possible. It did not exhaust the phenomenon at all. It's just
right.
Like, here's like the essential qualities that make the thing what it is, but other than that, you haven't gotten to the particulars of it yet.
Right.
For him, that's all categories were. It was like, here's the formal description, and that's it. It wasn't a means to control anything, because you don't know enough about the thing they control. You mean way more than just the formal description of it. You know, I know categorically the difference between a fish and a bird.
Yeah.
It's another thing to say, like, well, because I know this categorical thing about birds, I can then do X with them.
Uh-huh.
Because that, doing X with them, raises other questions, like not the formal cause, which is the formal descriptive thing, but rather the final cause. Like, well, what are
That's
birds
right.
for?
Exactly.
Like, what are they actually for? If what you're doing with them doesn't line up with what they're for, then you're doing something wrong. Like, you're going against their birdness.
Exactly.
In whatever
right.
way. And I feel like, I don't know what it would be called. Maybe it's a category error or something like that, but I don't know what it would be called. But acting like, well, because I have the formal definition, therefore I know exactly how to treat this thing in all times and all places, is incorrect.
Right.
Right? Just because I have this, I think that's,
You need the nature of the thing.
Yeah,
you need the final end, the
nature,
telos.
The nature of the thing, the telos of the thing. This argument has happened before when people try to use, in like the conservative and progressivist debate, when people, particularly conservatives, use like statistical data about crime rates or IQs or something like that. And the progressive response is because they use those statistics, they're like being racist and sexist and stuff. And the conservative response is that these are formal definitions. They don't exhaust the phenomenon at all.
Exactly.
This statistic about women is really says nothing about individual women and their own choices.
Right. Well said.
And I think that might be the essence of the problem, we've forgotten what categorization is for, and thus what we're using it for is to dominate and control.
Right.
If I can categorize you, white person, black person, male, female, brown, whatever, as X, that's not a means of me describing you. That's a means of me manipulating you and putting you in position to where I can manipulate you or move you in a certain way.
Very well said. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We need to be able to call people on the misuse of formal and final causes. That's a complicated thing. If you haven't studied philosophy, that's a complicated thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
But it is exactly right. And I think it's very important that we see categories as partial formal causes and not final causes. That's a great point, Jack. I think, too, that we... human beings, let me make a sort of further point about all this. I think human beings want to be able to have something really larger than ourselves.
Yes.
That we can associate ourselves with and in so doing give purpose and meaning to our lives. And one of the most dangerous people in the world would be someone who has adopted the wrong cause and is willing to die for it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Somebody who is so committed to, say, genetic cleansing,
yeah,
that he's willing to gas all the Jews.
Right.
Somebody who's so committed to ideological perfection that he's willing to kill all of his political enemies.
Right. But he does it heroically.
In his mind, he's being heroic.
And even is willing to die to protect others who are believing the same way he is.
That's right. That's right. So a real human desire to have something bigger than yourself is a good thing, and yet it can be attached to wrong causes and actually lead to a kind of fanaticism in that cause. Well, I've started thinking, well, if there are wrong causes, that means there must be right causes. And you can pick, it seems to me, you can pick things that are worthy causes, like defense of your family or defense of your country. And even those causes can go awry. And it slowly dawned on me, maybe the problem with causes is not just that there are ideological ones and non-ideological ones. That's a fairly good distinction. But maybe it's that we establish causes for ourselves. And to the extent that we establish causes for ourselves, we run the risk of going awry. What I'm saying is, maybe the only cause that's worth dying for is the one that teaches you you need to die to causes.
Good night, everybody.
The whole Christian picture is that you die to yourself. That the problem with these causes is not so much that there are good ones and bad ones and you can decide which one you want to attach yourself to, but that all causes, as long as they're coming from me, mm-hmm, are inherently problematic.
Right.
Maybe the problem really is that I need to die to myself and actually live for somebody else altogether.
Right, someone else's cause.
Exactly. And then you have a cause from outside of yourself that fits the need that the human wants, but at the same time, you don't own it personally. It's somebody else's cause, you see. This is the whole take up your cross and die and be born again and all that whole idea that we talk about in Christian circles about what the spiritual life is really all about. It's about putting yourself actually to death. So maybe this whole dying to self thing is the only way to get you to a point where you have a cause that's actually worth dying for. So it's reciprocal. Well, here's the thing I see. You know, when somebody says white privilege or black race, you know, racism against blacks, any of the other kind of categorizations we've been talking about, all of those things actually become a kind of ideology or kind of a cause to throw myself behind and even maybe to die over, fall on the sword for, in order to bring about justice or to bring about, you know, fairness or to treat people right. Well, if I have died to myself and I'm taking up the portion of that thing that God wants me to take up, then it can have some hope for success. But if I haven't died to myself, if I'm just in a sense what they call virtue signaling with my position, all men are patriarchal, and and as a man, when I say that, I make the women swoon.
You know what I mean?
It's like that.
Right.
So I am a really good guy because I do the right thing. See here, well then I'm still on the wrong side of that line. I'm making up a cause, in a sense, for myself in order to manipulate the situation to the way I want it to be, whether it's women swooning or some kind of sense of justice that I myself hold.
Yeah, you can see that on the virtue signaling thing, especially. My gosh, it's so insidious and difficult because
it's
like
so insidious.
You could honestly be technically speaking on the right side of something.
Yeah.
But the very reason you're there is totally selfish and meant to dominate and manipulate. What is it Eliot said that, like, something is like the final treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason? I can't remember. It was like last betrayal is the final treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's something like this.
Well, and that fits in with what we were talking about. Say someone sees the oppressive nature of men in instances of oppression or abuse of men's power over women, and rightly then defines that as evil.
Mm-hmm.
That it is evil. Rightly defines that as evil. Slaps the word patriarchy on it, even though it doesn't fit. And then has this tool by which to describe that very real wrong. See, well, she's doing a good thing in the sense that she's trying to point a finger at something that's an abuse. But the problem is when she slapped that term on it, it suddenly was a, well, what's the metaphor we use? A too broad a brush or whatever.
Yeah.
It was actually undermining the thing that she was hoping to get a hold of by being too general.
She may have very well created new categories and new prejudices just by the use of the term.
Right. And actually the result of all that is resentment and opposition from those who haven't been abusive, and she doesn't know what to do with that. They're just denying the reality that she genuinely saw, okay? She really did see this abuse. But maybe it was her parents, maybe it was her father, you know, maybe it was her boss, maybe it was somebody in particular. But whatever it is, to the extent that it's true, you want to be able to hold on to that, right, and call a wrong a wrong. But when you categorize, miscategorize like that, you actually, in a sense, you throw a smokescreen over it all. You can't see it as clearly as you would if you were to say, on Tuesday afternoon, this one guy was abusing this one girl.
Yeah. Recently, it's come to a head where the cover's been ripped off, the mask has been pulled off, and it's revealed that our entire discourse is just full of nothing but manipulative power plays over and over and over again. It doesn't matter what side you're on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of all the things that happened. We were just talking before the podcast about, like, two recent things I have. One was Sarah Huckabee Sanders getting kicked out of the restaurant.
Oh, the restaurant.
And, of course, all the hubbubaloo, if we can call it that.
hullabaloo
it was
hubbub.
Almost, it was almost like a
hubbubaloo.
It was like a hubbubalooza, almost.
Nicely done.
In regards to, like, the thing on the border where, like, children are being separated from their parents. And there was a discussion to be had about, like, you know, civil behavior at restaurants and about our immigration policies and like, issues and things like that. But it seemed like nobody wanted to have that discussion.
Yeah.
Everybody just wanted to take both those issues and turn it into ammunition for attacking, virtue signaling, and positioning and manipulating everybody else.
Right.
You know, if you, I could go into the examples, but it was just ludicrous. It was, you know, pictures that were not true or were being used the wrong way, and then people's responses being just utterly ungracious and uncompassionate toward people who are actually in distress. But the reason we talk that way is to show on whose side we are, so we can like position ourselves and make ourselves and let everyone else know. It's all manipulation, control, positioning, attack, reattack. Whatever, like people actually, children actually being helped, or a helpful discussion about civility. Just never happen. Or if they are happening, they're just going to be completely buried under everything.
So true.
And it's so much like, and again, it may just be like on social media and just in the ether, but if you sat down with somebody over like a coffee in a bar somewhere, I don't know why you have coffee at a bar, but like whatever, you just go somewhere and you just sit down and talk to someone face to face, you'd have the more nuanced discussion. But it does seem like a lot of our discourse, at least popularly and loudly, is so dominated by language that's just meant to manipulate and control rather than actually describe or try to arrive at truth or something like that. It just seems
I wonder how much, this is for another podcast probably, but I wonder how much of that happens because we are such an electronic society now that we get information from, you know, cable news networks, and we debate things on Facebook, and we don't really have one-on-one conversations in coffee bars. I'm okay with coffee bars. But I mean, if you sat down across from somebody, especially somebody you already know, and you know he's sane, you know, he's not a flaming crazy person from the other side, and you tried to actually work something out, there would be the bond of human sort of proximity and human interaction at a personal level that would, in a sense, put some limits on the flaming and the accusations and the hyperbole all that.
Like I said, we've already mentioned it. It's like it is that tension and contradiction of, you know, all men are the problem. Well, I happen to. Well, I'm not talking about you.
Right.
Well,
why
do you want to limit it to that? Well, because maybe you know that person, or you're talking to that person, or you want to take him at face value. You know,
like if you can categorize people, and then vilify them, and then talk about them in the third person, and offer political solutions. It's a gasoline fed dumpster fire. That will lead to a civil war.
That's a good way to put it. Oh my gosh,
that's what we're looking at.
Oh gosh, maybe that is a good discussion for another time.
Sure,
but it does seem we could conclude, if we can conclude, that part of the problem we are seeing with racial, whether it's racial reconciliation, or dealing with patriarchy, or dealing with the feminazis or the libtards or the crypto fascists or whatever you want, or the fake news media or whatever, it seems that we're regularly using categorization as a means of abuse and manipulation instead of just mere description, formal description. And we're treating, as says, because we're not using it as formal description, we're assuming a bunch of final teleological stuff about it. That, well, if I'm describing you as that, then that means you are this essentially and ultimately, and this is what your goal. If you're a feminist, then that means you're out to destroy the republic because you hate men or something like that, or something like that. That's part of the problem, and it's a big part of our culture. It's a big part of our fallenness because we're driven to dominate, to make things to be God. Basically, we're driven to be God. It's
That's
just another way
fallenness.
We're driven to be God.
Yeah.
And I think that definitely is tainting much of our discussion.
Yeah. So true.
Well, sir.
Let me just say, I think, too, that I want to remind that we are dealing with people, human beings, made in the image of God. And no matter what they believe or think, what ideas they hold, they are to be treated with dignity. Not because you agree with them, but because they're made in the image of God. That's a hugely different thing.
Yeah.
And as a result, we then focus on the right things, it seems to me. Then if we put that piece into place in the jigsaw of our interaction, if you put that piece into place, then you're left with room to debate the ideas without insulting the person. And that focuses on our common humanity and perhaps can lead to a kind of epistemological humility where we all recognize that we only see a certain part of the issue clearly, and that we actually need each other in order to see the whole issue, or at least better see the issue.
Yes.
So we actually need people who can sharpen us, iron sharpening iron and all that. And I think that's if you start there, I think the pressure cooker of these debates might step down a little bit. And combine that with this idea that that categories themselves, categories of people, I think you said something really important, Jack, that categories are useful in formal purposes, but not for final purposes.
Yes.
And in doing that, you take the pressure off too. You've treated them as individuals. You've treated them with dignity, and you've addressed their ideas with clarity. And then you also recognize that categories can be useful only in terms of informal terms rather than in final terms. That could be very useful.
I think so.
Yeah.
Especially when in your own engagement with people.
Yeah.
At all times.
Yeah.
Recommendations, sir?
Well, I would love to recommend this. I haven't read it all yet, but I have read bits of it, and I'm using it in preparation for a lecture this July. But I'm fascinated with the idea of reason. We did this little plug for our Radius project that talks about the essence of how we know things and the importance of the imagination in regard to knowing,
right,
to reasoning. Well, the medievals, I think, had that understood that idea, that place of the imagination, better maybe than we do as post-romantics. But there's a book I'm fascinated to read. I've only read snatches of it, and I already know I like it a lot. It's called Imagination, Meditation, and Cognition in the Middle Ages by a woman called Michelle Carnes, who is a professor at a university that I forget. But anyway, I'll maybe give her credit for that another
Carnes,
time.
That's Carnes,
K-A-R-N-E-S. That's right,
Michelle
K-A-R-N-E-S.
I've read the first couple of chapters of that, too.
You've read it,
very,
too. Right?
Very, it's academic stuff, but it's not total. It's not super dense.
Yeah.
And it's very engaging and interesting stuff.
Well, the whole idea of imagination playing a big role in how we know things, I think, is essential when we're talking about a spiritual world that we're trying to get to know, and that's kind of what our 18-part series is about. For those of you who don't know, look up Radius on our website. You can see it at centerws.com/radius for this 18-episode series of lectures that are on that idea of reason, faith in reason and the imagination.
Yes.
So this is going to be helpful because I'm talking this summer at a conference on reason. And I'm going to be trying to call people back to a kind of medieval understanding of imagination.
Okay. Well, I'm going to recommend a book as well. And I thought of it while we were talking here. There's a German Catholic philosopher, Pieper, I think it is, J-O-S-E-F, Joseph, and then Pieper is P-I-E-P-E-R. And he wrote a bunch of things, but one little thing he wrote, and by little I mean it's like the book's like 50 pages. It's like 50, 55 pages, real tiny. It's called Abuse of Language, Abuse of Power.
Sounds great.
And it circles around this idea that the abuse of language, like the misuse of language, is what gives rise to tyranny. Right? And so it's a book, and it's about like how language being used for manipulation and control rather than to describe reality.
Fits right in with what we've been talking about.
Yeah. Like, I think if it's not that long, it's like 50, 55 pages, tiny little book. Want to pick it up, Joseph Pieper, J-O-S-E-F-P-I-E-P-E-R, Abuse of Language, Abuse of Power. Check it out. It's worth a read.
Excellent.
All right, that's all we got for today. This has been From the Center, and we will see you next time.
So long.